This is the Context Podcast. Context Magazine is a publication of the American Sociological Association.
In this episode, we talk with Priscilla Parkhurst Ferguson, professor of sociology at Columbia University, about her upcoming piece in Context Magazine. Professor Ferguson is the author of Word of Mouth, What We Talk About When We Talk About Food. In her article for Context, she takes us inside the extreme sport of competitive eating. Thank you so much for joining us.
Always fun to talk about food.
So my first question is, how was it exactly that you came to study competitive eating?
Well, it's a long process. I've been interested for a zillion years in cultural identity. I started out a rather roundabout way to sociology from French literature, but I worked on 19th century French literature, which is also the same time as the birth of sociology. And I guess if I'm a sociologist, it's because of Balzac, because what the writers of that period were interested in was what's different, what's new about this. And then I began to ask questions, well, you know, French literature, why is it French? Who says it's French? In other words, asking sociological questions. After a few years, I ended up with in food, French cuisine. French always talk about it. Everyone else talks about it. Why is it French? Who says it's French? What makes it French? How do we know it's French? So looking at food practices is a way of getting, for me, of getting a cultural identity. Now, this all also coincided with the beginnings of food studies and more general interest in food practices, both in university settings, but also outside of university settings. And the competitive eating, the sport of competitive eating is certainly an example of that interest.
So in the article, you didn't have very much space to talk about the methods you use. So how did you go about doing your research?
My inspiration in all of this is Walter Benjamin and his work on the arcades and the Arcades Project about Paris in the 19th century. What Benjamin does is just sort of pick up on everything that he can find, put his hands on, whether it's obscure journalistic pieces or poetry or whatever. It's really the scholar as scavenger. And today, the internet and YouTube allow us to scavenge further and further. And that's how I came across some of this work, presentations of competitive eating. It goes viral on YouTube, among other places.
So have you gone to any of these competitions?
I've watched it on ESPN, like several million other Americans. And that is one of the most interesting things. Why do people want to watch other people scarf food? And you're doing, it's food behavior that we are taught not to do. That's what Elias taught us in the civilizing process. It's a civilizing process. That's what it's all about, is putting form into food. Well, this is food behavior that dispenses with form. And there's neither aesthetic form nor any kind of dining form or whatever. As one of the competitors says, it's not pretty. And indeed it is not. All you have to do is go on YouTube and look at the Nathan's hot dog contest from, last year. And it is indeed not pretty.
So in case there are any listeners who aren't familiar with these competitions or haven't seen any of them on ESPN, could you describe what the experience is like?
Well, I can do a little history first. The Nathan's Hot Dog Contest, which is probably the best known, started in 1916, and four immigrants decided to show their Americanness by eating as many hot dogs and American food as possible. And the Nathan's contest has been held every year on the 4th of July, with the exception of 2 years during World War II. It then went sort of big time in about the 1990s when Nathan signed on to the Sports Network And it began being organized as a sport with the MLE, which is Major League Eating, and the sort of international branch, the IFOCE, which is the International Federation of Competitive Eaters. And this organization ranks eaters and sponsors contests over the world, but most what I'm interested in is the United States. The experience is how much food can one stuff into one's gullet in a short period of time. It's 10 minutes for the hot dog. The record set last year is 69 hot dogs in 10 minutes. Now, if you think of eating a hot dog, I don't know how long it takes you, but the notion of 69 hot dogs in 10 minutes is pretty amazing.
I find it hard to fathom eating 69 hot dogs in 10 days.
Exactly. But so this is where it's the advocates talk about it as a sport. There's training. You don't fast before a meal. You train by eating more. And what's particularly interesting to me is that it's food behavior that's anti-food. What you eat is not important. There are contests from everything from mayonnaise to sushi to chicken wings. To oysters, to prairie oysters, just almost anything that we can consume with the hands can be turned into a competitive eating. And so it's not the overeating that's so different. I mean, there's been overeating at American county fairs for many, many decades. Sort of a staple pie eating contest or whatever. But the notion that you're eating in competition against time, that sets it, puts it into the sports mode, or its advocates want to put it into a sports mode. And that's the big difference.
So you're saying that the advocates of competitive eating want to present it as a sport. How much do you think that audience is accepted as a sport?
Well, certainly all the paraphernalia are there. If you watch it again, there are cheerleaders, there are people egging them on, there are coaches, there are presentations of rather like wrestling more than that, of someone coming in with a big introduction. So it's a sport, but it's a transgressive sport because it's showing behavior that we, quote, know, unquote, that we shouldn't do. And it's being approved. It's being applauded. So it's this sort of guilty pleasure without the guilt and without any of the possibly bad consequences of indigestion or so forth. But the sports is definitely the key to it. Presentation in the United States. In Japan, so far as I can tell, I'm rather limited knowledge, the sports aspect is pretty much non-existent.
So is this something that is mostly only taking place in America, or is it something that has international equivalents, you just mentioned Japan?
Well, it seemed to have come from Japan about the same time as the big competitive cooking show Iron Chef in the 1990s. This took off rather later in the United States. So Japan and the United States, Canada. But when I explain, talk about this to my French friends, they haven't a clue as to what I'm talking about. There isn't really a translation that makes any sense at all. It's against anything they or I can think of about typical or model French food behavior. Whereas it fits in with a lot of sort of American kinds of food behavior. I mean, the United States has been associated with abundance ever since the first settlers got here. It's tons of turkeys running around and so forth. And eating or consumption is a way of, in some ways, honoring that abundance. I mean, take Thanksgiving. You don't choose at Thanksgiving between the sweet potatoes and the mashed potatoes. You eat both, and you supposed to eat both. And you can talk to any number of my students will say, oh, Thanksgiving's coming up. I can't wait to pig out. And it's allowed it. You know, it's our national holiday is one of overeating. Plus now football, which is absolutely not unrelated, I think. So this sort of excess as something that we can enjoy by proxy, it's sort of part of a certain Americanism. And then it goes back to, you know, the ESPN and the Nathan's contest on the 4th of July. This year, one of the contestants was a soldier who had been given leave from his unit in Afghanistan to compete. Now, you don't usually get leaves from your military unit in a critical place for the Army to compete in something like this, but he was there for that.
Yeah, well, one thing that really interests me about these competitive eating competitions is how it's a mix, because on one hand, there's something really transgressive about the overeating, but on the other hand, as you talk about in the article, it fits in so perfectly with American culture, American values.
Very, very definitely. That it's a way of showing your Americanness, as it was for the immigrants in 1916 in the original Nathan's hot dog. And I think, you know, county fairs, it's a way of showing allegiance to local foods and so forth. But here it's the competition. It's also the mixture of amateur and professional. I mean, to get to the Nathan's competition, you have to go through elimination trials. You can't just turn up on Coney Island on July 4th and start to compete. You go through all kinds of elimination contests. And so there are rankings. There are websites that give the rankings of who's got the hot dog contest and who has the mayonnaise contest and so on. And what's also interesting is size. Now, intuitively, you'd think that all these competitive eaters would have to be enormous. And in the early days, one of the star performers was a New York taxi driver who weighed 400 pounds. But the big game changer was the Japanese Takeru Kobayashi, who first competed in the around 2000 or so, who was 5'5", he weighed 102 or something like that. And he almost doubled the record on his first try, so that put people into overdrive. One of the top-ranked competitive eaters is a woman, Sonia Thomas, who weighs 105 and is very much into training and so forth. So the size, so it's not tied to obesity. It's tied to training. Is Joey Chestnut, who is the number one ranked in these days, says it's not about food, it's about drive, and it's certainly not about hunger, it's about drive and determination. Well, that's exactly what you'd see for anyone in baseball, in runners, in Olympic sports, so on. And there has even been talk of turning this into an Olympic sport, which somehow I don't think will fly, but one can always dream.
So one of the other things you talk about in the article is how extreme eating blurs class distinctions and places the body front and center. Could you talk a little bit more about that?
Well, we are taught to, quote, civilize ourselves by using knives and forks instead of our hands and so forth. Americans have American foodways have a lot on use of hands. The hot dog is eaten with hands. By the way, I should note that you have to eat the bun with the hot dog. So it's not just 69 hot dogs, it's 69 hot dogs and 69 buns. So the body, you know, sort of tied to gluttony. We often think about it officially, gluttony is sort of excess desire, whereas this goes against, on the one hand, that excessive desire that you can't control in your desire for food. That's not it at all. It's very much controlling any desire. This is again, just like Joey Chestnut, drive and determination. But, you know, think about, you know, how we are to discipline our body as part of living. So, you know, we are, you know, we wear clothes, we cover up, we, if you follow the notion of increasing constraints on behavior, it's, you know, keeping the body in place. That's what table settings do. We have our own little taste settings, and we don't reach over and pick off something off someone else's plate. But of course, sometimes we do. But still, there's a slight guilty pleasure on that, especially if the other person is going to defend his own plate with knives and forks and so on. So it's this this discipline that simply goes by the boards in this, and we get to see the spectacle of what we don't do in our daily lives. And you know, it's also that the more intellectual work tied to the head, the more intellectual senses of sight and hearing are placed ahead of the sort of the dirty body senses of taste, touch, and smell. Well, this gets you right in the middle of taste, test, and smell. And also, when we're talking about eating, we don't tend to think about how much the body works. I mean, slurping, we're not supposed to slurp, visible signs of eating. In African societies, it's often a sign of that you've had a good meal, that you belch, and you belch, the better you belch, the better the meal is to have been for you. Well, so our relationship to the body in that way, I think, is conflict. That's also changed a lot in the past, I don't know, 20, 30, 40, 50 years, wherever you want to take as your starting point.
And so do you see extreme eating as extreme examples of tendencies or trends that we see in increasingly in regular eating, or is it something in its own sphere that we watch because it's so unlike what we normally do?
Well, it's both. On the one hand, it's safe because it's so unlike what we normally do. On the other hand, it is time. I mean, how do you eat hot dogs? You eat hot dogs with your hands. You probably don't eat mayonnaise the way they eat mayonnaise in this, but you know, it's extreme, so it's obviously out of the ordinary. On the other hand, it's close enough to the way we play with food. I mean, it's a food fight. Just, you know, food fights have an appeal from 3-year-olds on up in some way. So yes, there are connections, the blurring of social class borders, that if anyone watches Downton Abbey, all the forms are there. There's no competitive eating in Downton Abbey. The competition turns up in other spheres, which is fairly clear. That it turns down into eating is, you know, it's a whole different orientation. So it's both very, very different and very, very like what we are doing in our own lives. The pop-up restaurants that are around and the other kinds of food done with your hands, from tacos, burritos. There are food trucks all over the place, and most of it's finger food or food eaten with the hand. And you can just say there's a big change from, quote, finger food, dainty little cucumber sandwiches that you see in Downton Abbey, and, you know, these fat hot dogs that get stuffed into the face. But there is also a connection.
All right, so in terms of implications of your project, how does competitive eating challenge the ways in which sociologists have traditionally thought about food?
Well, sociologists haven't traditionally thought about food for all that long. They don't. Anthropologists have been far ahead of sociologists on this. I think sociologists tended to look at things like dining, forms of dining, production of food. Consumption comes in late. You can look, always date that to Veblen's The Theory of the Leisure Class, which talks about competitive, conspicuous consumption. Well, this is a new kind of conspicuous consumer. We have the conspicuous producer in The Celebrity Chef. A great deal has been written about that, although probably more journalism than sociology, though there are a good many studies of chefs coming out now. But here, this is moving to the conspicuous consumption in the very strict sense of the term. It's also challenging because it, in some ways it seems so pointless. I mean, why do it? I still don't have a very good answer of why this consumption is so interests so many people. And if you look on YouTube, you will see that there are a great many, a fair number of people who organize their own competitive eating contest and then post the results on YouTube. So that they want to have their own mini glutton bowl out on YouTube. And so, yeah, so I don't have a really super explanation. It raises a great many questions about how we look at our behavior.
Well, those are all the questions I have for you. So thank you once again for joining us.
No, thank you for it.
It was great talking to you and hearing about your research. And Priscilla's article will appear in the summer 2014 issue of Context Magazine.
Which is a great place for great sociologists.